They can't let you be just for a couple of hours, can they? You're so important to the world. You have to be on call all the time. As long as you can serve them, they'll come worshipping you at your feet and begging you and pleading to you and cajoling you and praising you and honoring you and giving you titles and all sorts. But wait until you become useless to them. And then just as you throw away a used tissue paper, they won't care a bit. You've seen this happen to others, haven't you? So housekeeping. Don't let them bother you while you're here. That's all. Who's them? Them. Don't let them bother you. You are no bother to any of us. Because to us everything is an object for reflection. That's all. If a ringing phone can annoy us or bother us, then what have we achieved? Isn't it? But don't let them bother you while you're here. So do yourselves a favor. And do the obvious. I needn't spell it out, do I? I don't like Mara having it his way. Because this is all the time you have for yourself. What other time do you have for yourselves? And that is why, despite there being the cutting ceremony at the monastery today, we have decided to come and be with you. So all of our high ordained monks are at the monastery today, and they'll be receiving the cutting robe offering from our devotees. All but... Oh well. Perhaps I should be doing more merits. No, I'm here because I'm happy to be here. I promised you, if my heart still beats and I'm able to get here in one piece, then I will be here even if there's just one of you. Because there are very few people who actually want to work towards their salvation. Very few. Very few and far between. So when you claim that you want to do that for yourselves, save yourselves from samsara, save yourselves from ignorance and attachment, and free yourselves from desire, aversion and delusion, and when you claim that your only refuge is the Noble Triple Gem, then it is the Buddha's commandment to us as monks to go forth and heal those hearts and mend those minds and to help people achieve their salvation. So that is what we are here for today. So without further ado then, let's begin. We have a lot to get through. We also had an overnight pirit chanting. Some of you may know. And because I always have you in my thoughts, just before I left the monastery, the pirit chanting had concluded just before. And I collected the first 100 or so pirit threads so you can have them. So I've got them with me. If you stick around till the end. It has been blessed by all of our monks, including Guru Swami and Vahanse. So they all take part in the pirit chanting. And it carries the blessing of the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. I'll explain to you the significance of a pirit thread. It is not just a decoration around your wrist. It's not a bracelet. As some might like to believe. It's not a bracelet. It's not a fashion trend, although it is considered by some to be fashionable. It's not a fashion. It has very deep significance. It has a lot of meaning. So I'll explain to you what that is before I give you your first pirit thread. And we are very fortunate today to have two monks present here, who will do the tying. I'll do the giving. They can do the tying. We can do all that at the end. You just need to stick around. The best things come to those who wait. All right, so let's begin this. Let us all take a moment to first and foremost pay reverence to His holy name, the supremely enlightened one, the fully awakened one, the magnificent one, the omniscient one, the unparalleled one. There's none like Him in 10,000 world systems. The seeker of the truth and the proclaimer of the truth, our guide, our teacher, our master. He who has laid it down very clearly and so distinctly, so that all of us can follow in His footsteps and achieve the same liberation that He did, no different at all. What a great teacher to offer, to make available to His students the very same bliss that was available to Him, that He discovered all by Himself with no support. Such a great man He was. So let us bring our palms together in veneration of the supremely enlightened Buddha. And let us also take a moment to observe the precepts, seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem, and remind ourselves our purpose of being here as we take upon a pledge of allegiance to our liberation, to our freedom. Let us do that before we begin.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Have you seen a change of faces in our Anagarika Mahatyas? Yes? What happened to the old one? You are familiar with two faces, used to come very regularly. One right from the start. He used to drive us here and back safely. Very loyal gentleman. Loyal to the Buddha, loyal to the Dhamma, and loyal to the Sangha. Been with us for just over a year. What happened? We killed him. He's no more. Well, soon to be no more. So after a year of training at the monastery, all of our Anagarikas, they prepare for their ordination. We have at least a 1 year training program. Because we want to ensure that they are sure that this is for them. I've always told you, what needs to come first? A monk's robes or a monk's attitude? Well, you know the answer now. A monk's attitude needs to come first. Because if you throw a robe on a monkey, that doesn't make them a monk. It doesn't work like that. You need to ensure that they're a monk first. You need to ensure that they have compassion towards themselves and all sentient beings. And particularly that they don't see a difference between them and others. Because in the philosophy that we believe in, ladies and gentlemen, in what we believe the Buddha taught us, my Nibbana does not precede anybody else's Nibbana. Nibbana is Nibbana. If there's someone who's fighting for their salvation, then most of the time salvation doesn't come. Now this might go, you might be confused a little bit about, but I write at the beginning, most of last week's sermon I've been talking about, you know, work towards your salvation, find some refuge for yourself, find some recluse for yourself, because you're far too busy looking after each, you know, every other person's and all other people's wants and needs. Who's going to be looking after yourself? So I ask you to do something for yourselves as well. So this is not at odds with what I've just said before. It's the same thing. It's the same thing, but it's a little bit more profound. What I mean by that, it'll come clear
as you go further in the Dhamma. We needn't worry too much about how the two things can mean the same thing. So the two things being, I tell you that it's Nibbana is Nibbana. It's not my Nibbana, your Nibbana, her Nibbana, or his Nibbana. Nibbana is Nibbana. If we are fighting for my Nibbana, then that is not a Nibbana that's ever going to come, because we understand by now that self is only a creation of the mind. So if you're fighting for my self's Nibbana, then that is not Nibbana at all. But then at the same time I say, do ensure that you work towards your salvation. So really what I mean is, work towards salvation. If you're working towards salvation, then salvation will happen. To whom? Salvation will happen. Nibbana will happen. Bliss will happen. The very fact that we have this question, to whom will it happen, is the question to which you will realize there is no answer. So for now, if that seems like a riddle, it's all right. Let's just carry on and it'll all become clear. Because you see some heads nodding vigorously in the audience. Yep, got it, Swami Nansa, got it. Others are like, what? Too much for a Sunday morning. It's all right. Just give yourself some time. In any case, so where's that gentleman that used to come here? He's gone. So after his year of training as an Anagarika, spending his time with the monks and doing practically everything at the monastery. You know, a lot of the people who walk through our gates, ladies and gentlemen, you know, they come from all walks of life. But there's one thing that over the last 6 to 7 years of my being at the monastery, something that I've noticed is, you know, a lot of them they're very young, a lot of them in their youthful years. I think the average age at our monastery is probably around the 25-30 mark, and we have about 120 now. So you can get an idea. So you can understand that it is not people who've kind of, you know, lost interest in life. It's not people who are fed up of life. It's not people who've lost someone in their family, because, you know, they're too young for that to happen. To be fed up of life, to be disgusted of life. That's not why they come. They all come seeking the truth because they have heard the truth. It happens. I'm waiting for my first Anagarika from here. When is that going to happen? Or perhaps an Anagarika. We have almost 90 Anagarikas at the monastery. So there's a sister monastery or a sister campus, which is just about a kilometer off from where we are, just short of. And they live a life just as holy as us. By holy, I mean working towards salvation. Working to eradicate desire, aversion and delusion from their mind so that they can be free. So that sights don't bother them, sounds don't bother them, smells don't bother them, touch doesn't bother them, people don't annoy them. You know, this is not about secluding oneself from the world. This is us training ourselves to be at peace with the world so that anything is okay. That is the training that we give them. So after a year of their training, all our Anagarika Mahathayas, they change their dress. So their dress code goes from what you see, this is the white, to something that is similar to this color. And in that, they go through an extended training for a month and a half or so, sometimes a bit more than that. An extended training. The last few ticks, crossing the T's and dotting the I's to ensure that they really, really, really are ready for monkhood. So we really give them some strenuous tests in those last couple of months to ensure that this is what they really want. And they have dedicated their lives to this. That is why our retention rate is very high. Unfortunately, when we go to Malvatta once a month or so to meet the Mahanayaka Thera, he shares with us some of the statistics. And this is such a sorry state of affairs. More requests come to him from monks who wish to disordain than young men and women who wish to ordain. And I believe that is because they're not ready yet. Remember, I always tell you, it is not about giving up. It is not about letting go. If there are things you want in life, but you physically try to let them go, your mind will still seek them. Your mind will still yearn for them. Your mind will still beg for them. And there'll be a point where any longer, you're going to go insane. So at that point, what do you do? You have to make a choice. Do I stay in robes, but I have to be virtuous? Yeah, because that is one of the worst things you can do, be in robes and be unvirtuous. It's better to disrobe than to be in robes and do things that are not fitting. Just think about the image that sometimes some people who are in robes have left in your minds. Just think about it. I don't need to spell them out to you because you've seen this stuff. You've seen this stuff on TV, you've seen this stuff in the papers, you've seen this stuff on YouTube. Yeah, I mean, sorry for saying this, but for your sins, you've seen those stuff. Because what happens is when you see that stuff more than the good stuff, what tends to happen is people believe that, what is the point of monkhood? The true Buddha Sasana does not prevail any longer, it has perished. The Buddha Sasana has no life in it any longer. It is just a robe now. And true freedom can no longer be achieved from it. True freedom and true bliss can no longer be achieved from it. If it were possible, then how come robe bearers behave in this manner will sometimes be the questions that you ask. So it is far better, if you are not ready, to disrobe and go back into lay life, and then come back when you're ready. That's perfectly fine. So this is why at our monastery, what we do is, we make sure that they're ready for it. We do a thorough check before we take them in. As Guru Hamdra always says, it's very difficult to come in, but it's very easy to go at our monastery. It's very difficult to get in. The selection criteria is very high. In other words, it's a rigorous test. So you can take up to 2 years to check whether you're ready for it. But in 1 year, if you feel you're ready and your teachers also agree, and we have a Sangha council at the monastery, and if the Sangha council agrees with Guru Hamdra's blessings, then we line them up for an ordination date. But in that period of a year, they go through this training. The training of becoming a good human being initially. Because there are various practices you will have brought along with you. There are some young men who come and they are addicted to various things. Smoking, drinking, gambling. Yes, and that. But over the course of a year, through the Dhamma, no punishments. We don't lock them up in a dark room. No, we don't do that. We've never done that. I mean, if you had to do that, what good is the Dhamma? Very lovingly, with tender, loving care, we teach them the Dhamma. And they become ambassadors. I mean, speak to some of the Anagarika Mahathas who come with us and you will see the transformation that has been made in their lives, that they have been able to achieve through the Dhamma. Of course, you will not have met them before they were Anagarikas, in which case you would have been able to make that comparison. But, you know, speak with them and see whether they are, you know, like the normal human beings that you see outside. The way they conduct their speech, the way they behave themselves, the way they act towards other sentient beings, you know, very, very compassionate. That is the training that they get. Remember, I always tell you, the test is not how much of the Dhamma that you have understood. That's not the test. You know, to check whether they are ready for ordination, the test we give them is not whether they can read scriptures or memorize the scriptures from the Tripitaka. It is whether they have become good human beings. That is the test that we give them. So that is what we do. Anyhow, so the Anagarika Mahatma who did you all a great service by doing what? By ferrying Swami Nuhanse across. For the last, I don't know, how many months now? How many? Three? Four? How many, madam? 5 months? 6 months? That long? Okay. Time flies. So for the last 6 months, he's been ferrying Swami Nuanse across from the monastery, safely here, and then back to the monastery on arms rounds, taking Swami Nuanse around on Pindapatha, where the poor people are, and still ensuring his safety, the monk's safety as well. That's a big responsibility. How many times have you requested from the monastery to stop us from going on arms rounds? I understand why. Because you feel that, you know, it might be a threat to Swami Nuanse's safety. Because you hear of the things that go on around, you know, the country. So many of you have had made such requests. Please, can we stop Swami Nuanse from going on arms rounds? And I think that is why you ensure to fill that arms bowl right up to the brim. I know your ways. You are a cunning lot. What about that gift of giving? Huh? Have you forgotten all that now? But then he was always there. He said, not to worry. I will take responsibility. I will ensure your safety, Swami Nuanse, and ensure that you are back at the monastery safe and sound. And he always did. So for 6 long months he was doing that, all the while preparing for his ordination. And with his parents' blessings, his wife also has now become an Anagarika. She has been an Anagarika for, well, ever since he became an Anagarika. A very well-to-do family. They spend most of their life in America. And very educated. You know, young people. They just, you know, they go looking for the truth. They go looking for happiness. And once they found it, they stop looking. I always tell you, the reason that you watch the second film is because the first film never made you happy. The reason you go to the restaurant for the second time is because the first time never made you happy. That is why we all stop when we come to the Sambuddhasasana. We don't go from here anywhere. There's nowhere to go. Because once you found what you were looking for, why seek any further? Why seek any more? You stop. This is where the search for the truth stops. This is where the search for happiness stops. Because here's where you find it. So in about a month and a half or so, he will enter robes, and that is what we have planned. So when the ordination ceremony is around the corner, I will let you know. If you would like to, you can of course come along and witness this young man who has been of great service to you, I think, for carefully bringing Swami Nuanse over here so that you can listen to the sermons and then taking him back safely. So I'll let you know when his ordination ceremony is up, and you can book the date in your diaries and visit the monastery so that you can be there for him and rejoice in that great event. I'm sure he'll be very pleased to see all of you there. He always speaks very highly of you on our way back. You know, he says various things. He says, Swami Nuanse, today there was this lady, she'd come for the first time and she was very enthusiastic about the Dhamma. I saw she was listening so attentively. And then there was this gentleman, and I saw him, he had brought something to offer Swami Nuanse, and then he saw that there was another chap stood next to him and who had nothing. And you know what he did? He offered everything that he had to him so that he could offer. So he says all these things to me on our way back, because I only look at my arms pull. I don't know what you're doing. I don't see your faces. But he's there with his camera, watching you, looking at what you're doing. And so he tells me all the good things that you get up to. So on the way back, all we do is sadhu, 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 sadhu. Up and down, I just keep rejoicing at all the good things that you all do. I mean, it's such a treat, you know, to be able to associate good people, kind-hearted people, generous people. You know, if you keep at this, if you keep at this, if you keep doing what you're doing today, ladies and gentlemen, you know, I'm dead certain you won't stop short of going to the heavens. I'm confident of that. But that is not where I want to get you. Because heaven or hell, they're still suffering. I have a bigger plan for all of you. Your destination need not be in the heavens, but if you keep on doing what you're doing, if you keep at this, be the kind-hearted people that you are, be compassionate towards all sentient beings, do the best you can and do all things selflessly. If you practice altruism, think little of yourselves and think a lot about others, especially when it comes to helping others to achieve their salvation, then you will not stop short of going to the heavens. Because the heavens need people like yourselves. They need it to balance the world. The world can only survive, the world can only exist if there's enough goodness to balance the badness. That is how the world survives. The world needs that. Good and bad, you know, they're on a fine balance. So goodness in hearts is needed to balance the badness, the evilness. You know how much evil is going on out there, right? You watch the television, you watch the news, you read the papers, you know what's going on out there. That's why recently one of our children brought a little airplane. You saw that? Yeah? One of our young doers who come to the sermon. She brought a little airplane. I wanted to show it to you last week, but one thing led to the other and I forgot all about it. So she's brought this airplane. And I asked her, why? Why have you brought an airplane? She wants me to fly to Gaza. She wants me to fly there and sort the problem out. Just think, you know, how soft-hearted these people are, these young children. Because what she thinks, she's been telling her mother, Amma, you know, if Swaminarayan can preach this Dhamma to people out there, if Swaminarayan can preach this Dhamma to people who suffer from aversion, from anger, from distrust, then they will begin to understand the truth. And they'll begin to realize that happiness is not in killing. Happiness is not in murder. Happiness is not in trying to get what belongs to somebody else. Happiness is within. And they will drop their weapons, won't they? So she's made this aircraft so that I can fly in there. That's why young children are highly impressionable, very impressionable. The influence that you take home with you, you know, you leave a big imprint on their minds. And that is what we should do as responsible adults as well. So you know how much evilness goes on out there. You know, this is not because people are bad. We need to understand that. Because if we think that people are bad, then we lose faith in humanity. That is not needed. I'm always going on about how valuable human life is, right? Humanness is something we have to celebrate. So people aren't bad, but there's badness in them. So we only hate the sin, but we love the sinner. Because every sinner has a future, just as every saint has a past. So all those people who are sinners today can be transformed into saints in the future. You know Angulimala, the great elder. You know his story. He was a great sinner back in the day, but thanks to the Dhamma, he gave up all his sins and he went on to become one of the most holy people that we've all heard of. Remember the Angulimala Pirita? A lot of you will be familiar with that. It is a pirit chanting that is used especially when women go into labor and they have trouble delivering the child. So on one occasion, Angulimala came to know, Angulimala the Thera at that point came to know that there was a woman in the village who had gone into labor, but she had much difficulty delivering the child. And then he was requested to help. So he went up to the Buddha and the Buddha said, Angulimala, here's the Pirita, you know, here's a discourse, short chanting. Why don't you go and chant this? And then all will be fine. And in that, in the Angulimala Pirita, it the very simple meaning of that is, I have not sinned, I do not kill, I have compassion towards all sentient beings, and by the virtue of that, by the power of that truth, may all beings be free of suffering. So Angulimala is now confused. Because here's a man who has killed many thousands of people. So he asks the Buddha, Venerable Sir, how on earth do you expect me to chant this? What right do I have to chant this? You know my history, you know my past. I've killed countless people. I'm responsible for the misery that has been brought on many families. Many children lost their fathers, many children lost their mothers, many husbands lost their wives, and many wives their husbands. So why do you think I am a suitable person? Why do you think I am fitting to chant this? Because it is not true if I were to chant this. And the Buddha said, Angulimala, that was before you got the Dhamma. That was when you were Pratakjana. But then I killed you, didn't I, Angulimala? And then you were born an Aryan. Now you are a member of the Aryan clan. You have been reborn as a saint. So as a saint, when have you ever killed anyone or even had any thoughts of killing? When have you ever? Angulimala says, never, Venerable Sir. Well, there you go then. Who is more fitting? Off you go. So he goes and he chants this sutta, and the delivery takes place without any trouble. So this is why even to this day, when women go into labor, it has become customary to chant the Angulimala Tirtha. So that's the history behind that. See, this is what the Dhamma does, ladies and gentlemen. Because I can say this because I know what it did for me. I know what it has done for me. I know how much I have changed as a result of understanding the Dhamma. And therefore, I know that anyone who walks this path, it matters not what your past is, anyone who walks this path will achieve the same liberation. You know, among us may be thieves. Among us may be philanderers. Among us may be womanizers. Among us may be murderers. Among us may be liars. Among us may be cheats. Among us may be traitors. So what? That is your past. It's not your future. I know sometimes your past will come to haunt you. I will remind you this from time to time because as the Dhamma begins to cleanse your mind, here's one of the side effects of that. You will begin to repent and regret some of the things of your past. It'll happen. Maybe you'll be reminded one of these days about how you mistreated or ill-treated your wife. Perhaps domestic abuse was just fashionable at home. Maybe it's just what happened every weekend. It was so frequent, so often. Such thoughts will come to you because as you begin to soften inside, you will become someone who can't bear such evilness. You will become someone who is so kind and so compassionate, and just the sheer memory of such things will begin to haunt you. So this is why I'm giving you this warning ahead of time. If such things begin to happen to you, just remember my words from today. Take a deep breath. It's okay. Relax. Because that is your past. I'm not here to change your past. Everyone has a past, an ugly past. It's okay. Maybe you don't have such an ugly past in this birth, but if you go back and look at some of the things you've done in the past, it'll make you sick. But it's okay. Maybe there are some among you who used to drink your socks off. Like every time you were seen with a bottle. Not a full one, a half empty one. And you were a menace, perhaps, to your society, to your family. Your kids hated being around you. Your wife maybe even despised you. Maybe you were the greatest source of misery to your husband because you just couldn't be at home. You're always looking for affection from others. Perhaps that is your story. All I have to say is, who cares? That's your past. That's your past. And I will teach you when that time comes, how you can overcome that. Because we all go through that. How do I know this? I remember reading it in a book. Huh? How do I know this? I didn't fall from the sky. I am a son of the soil. I was born on this earth. I've been through all these emotions and I had my teachers to guide me when I needed their help. So when such times come, fear not. Answers are all there in the Dhamma. Maybe you were the victim of domestic abuse. Perhaps there are some among you like that. And there's still hatred lingering in your hearts. Maybe it came to a point where you wanted to split up, but you couldn't because of the children. Perhaps that is some of your stories. Maybe there are more broken things at home than good ones. Maybe all of the doors have lost their handles. Maybe the drawers are half broken. Maybe the furniture used to be good, but no longer are they suitable for even sitting down. Because that's what happened. You know, the pieces of furniture at home, they saw, they took the brunt of your anger. Maybe the dog, if he could speak, would share with us all the vices that used to happen at home. It's all right. Everyone has a dark past. It's all right. Relax. It's all right. Honestly, it's all right. Because this will happen to you. As you become to soften inside, regret will come to you like an arrow in the darkness. You'll feel it sting. You will. And when it happens, it's all right. So I tell you up front, you know, if we've been doing this for 6 months, it's beginning to happen for some of you. I didn't realize it's been 6 months. If it is, then it's beginning to happen for some of you. You're beginning to have regrets. You're beginning to have repentances. You're beginning to think, oh, good Lord, how could I have treated her like that? Should I not have been a little bit more grateful? Why did I do that? Why did I do this? Oh, those lies I used to tell. How many times did I cheat on my wife? These things will come back to you. All I'm saying is, it's all right. I can't, of course, change the past for you. If there are deeds that were done, they will have their karmas. The karmas have been done and the vipakas are due to come. But remember, the Buddha gives us refuge. He teaches us how we can escape our own actions or the consequences of our own actions. All you got to do is become a sotapanna and you will never suffer any of the consequences that you are due to suffer in the four great hells. All you have to do is become a sotapanna. Oh, and by the way, there's a really good piece of news. This is an advantage that we have because our Buddha Sasana is a very short one. I've shared with you in the past, but I think at the monastery, not to this audience, so I will. This is a very sweet deal. You'll be very pleased that you've heard this. It is said that when the Buddha Sasana ends, in other words, there are no longer any individuals who are of noble states. So when the last Sotapanna has perished, then the Buddha Sasana is over. So it is not when people are wearing robes. You know, that may continue for much longer. But when the last Sotapanna, one who has attained the stream enterer, right, if when the last Sotapanna has perished, then the Buddha Sasana is no longer. It is said that when the Buddha Sasana comes to an end, there cannot be any beings who have attained noble states, not just in the human world, but in any of the Rupa worlds. And that includes the Brahma worlds. There are the Rupavachara Brahmavals and there are the Arupavachara Brahmavals. Let's not get too bothered about that. But there are the Rupavachara Brahmavals, and to get there, you must at least be an Anagami to get to that stage. So, this Buddha Sasana is a rather short one. Because they say our Buddha, the Gautama Buddha, was an extra Buddha. He was not due to come, but he did. So this Buddha Sasana's lifetime is 5,000 years, of which 2.5 has already lapsed. So how much do we have left? Actually short of 2,500. I think less than that now. So what that means is, in the next 2,500 years, if you are able to become a Sotapanna in this lifetime, now that you have the opportunity to become one, if you become a Sotapanna in this lifetime, in the next 2,500 years, you will become at least an Anagami, if not an Arahant. That is a cast iron guarantee. That is a great advantage, a great privilege that we can only get in a time where the Buddha Sasana is so short. Because when the Buddha Sasana perishes, in another 2,500 years' time, there cannot be any individuals who have attained noble states in the karma worlds. Not the Rupavachara worlds, in the karma worlds. So in the karma worlds you have the hells. Of course there are no individuals who have attained noble states in the hells. But there's the human world, and then there is the deva worlds. Yeah? So you will at least have become a Brahman. As in free from all sensual suffering. All you have to do is what then? Become a Sri Mantra. And what do you have to do for that? How long do you have to keep standing on one foot? How many meals do you have to skip? How much fasting do you have to do? How much self-torture do you have to do? How much do you have to let go? How much? Nothing. You're going to have, you have nothing, none of that to do. To become a Sotapanna, all you have to do is have the merits and then associate noble ones. Associate with someone who is able to give you that gift, the gift of Dhamma. So we don't know when we might encounter them. That is hard to say, but your merits will look after that. That's why I always encourage you to carry on doing merits. And whenever you do your merits, ladies and gentlemen, make a determination. By the power of these merits, may I and all sentient beings, not just I, may I and all sentient beings be able to attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Even if it's a small thing that you're doing, offering a glass of water, this, inviting the Swami Nohanse to make a sermon, to do a sermon. When you offer alms, when you come here and you bring someone along to a sermon, whatever you do, if you're doing something meritable, have that resolve in mind. Have that determination in mind. Because I think you're beginning to understand that anything short of that is not really worth having. Because remember, I reminded you this last week as well, everything that we have acquired, we are going to have to let go. Once we perish, and along with us will perish our sense of ownership, so the things that we think we own are only with us for as long as we are alive. What did you own from your last birth? Tell me. What do you know? Perhaps you were a great emperor. Well, we don't have to say perhaps, because you can't remember any of that. So your sense of ownership perishes with your death. So what you own is only very temporary, isn't it? How many children did you have in your last birth, and what were their names? Where are they now? Who knows? See, it's a very temporary ownership, and it is an ownership that we just have in our minds. It's not real. But all that will come clear as we go forward. But here's what I want you to do. Ensure you do as many merits as you possibly can. Those days when I was a layperson, I used to say, work hard, work smart, try and earn as much money as you possibly can. But now I realize money is not the answer. That is a currency that we can only use while we are alive. Money. But merit is the universal currency. In fact, the reason that you have money in the bank is because you have merits in the first place. It is merits that you then convert to everything else. A good life is merits converted into that. Money is merits converted into that. Have you not seen people sometimes, they work really hard, but they're poor. They work really hard. Night and day they sweat, they toil, but they don't get anything out of it because they just don't have the merits to earn anything. So working hard alone is not the answer. You need to have the merits. So how do we do merits? By doing good to others. What you give is always what you get. That is the universal phenomenon. Do try always to add a smile to another person's face and you will get it back in return. I promise you. Why is it that I'm always so happy? What do I spend my life doing? Why am I here today? To put a smile on your faces, right? That's why I'm always happy. It's not magic. It's pure logic. But for that you need the philosophy. You need to know how to do that. And that is what we're doing here. So earn as much merits as you possibly can, and your merits will guide you to the right place. If that is here, then so be it. If it's not here, then may your merits guide you to the right place where you are able to get noble association. We don't know where that's going to come from, unfortunately. If the Buddha were here, he would have said, go, associate the Venerable Sariputta. Go and associate the Venerable Moggallana. Go and associate the Venerable Rahula. They are noble associations from which only good can come to you. But alas, today we don't have the Buddha to give us that guidance. So we just have to rely on our own merits. That should be your compass. Make sense? Excellent. Right. Let's discuss some Dhamma then. What did we talk about last week? Manifestations? Anicca? What was it? Because I do the sermon on Saturday as well, sometimes I forget what we talked about last week. So you'll have to remind me. What did we talk about last week? Anicca? Alright. If that's what you want, then we'll continue on that topic. All we need to do is to try and understand the truth. We are all bodhisattvas. You may understand or know a bodhisattva as someone who is aspiring to become a Buddha. And when you think Buddha, you're thinking that. Perhaps. But a bodhisattva is one who is aspiring for the truth, because bodhi is the truth. All we are truth seekers. Because what does the truth do? It sets you free. That is why we learn, that is why we study, we learn science, right? Because we understand if we understand a particular science, if we understand the science of heat, then energy. See? If we understand the science of physics, we can build these things up for ourselves. Animals can't do that. That is why humanness is very important. You know, we have the intelligence, ladies and gentlemen, to manipulate nature. Nature has given us things, various things. Nature gives us what she has. And we as human beings, we have the intelligence to do stuff with that. So when nature gives us heat, we have the means, we have the intelligence to use that heat to fulfill our needs. When nature gives us water, we have the power, we have the intelligence to make use of that. When nature gives us calories, when nature gives us energy, we have the means, we have the intelligence to do something with that, whereas animals, they don't. Whereas we can use nature, nature uses other beings. But we have the intelligence to use nature. Now why do I say this? Because nature has given you your eyes, your ears, your nose, your tongue, your body, and the mind. It's down to us to put them to good use. Take a dog, for instance. Does a dog not have everything that you have besides the intelligence part? It's got eyes, it's got ears, it's got a nose, it's got a tongue, it's got a body, it's got a mind. But what it doesn't have is the intelligence to put that to good use. So therefore, a dog will always be doing dog things. Won't it? A dog will always be doing dog things. Have you seen a dog going to school? No. Have you seen a dog working at an office? No. Or running the country? No. 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 I'm a monk. No subtle innuendos here. Of course not. Dogs don't run the country. Human beings do. Okay? But as human beings, we have the capacity and the capability to make use of what nature has given us and put them to good use. What is good use then? Why are we all here? To free ourselves, aren't we? Because you know that suffering gets the better of you. You know that you all suffer. Whether that is stress or anxiety or depression or anger or desire, right? Wanting things all the time when you know you can't have them. That's so painful, isn't it? Regret, we talked about it just a few minutes ago. Don't you like to overcome these ailments, these mental ailments? Do you remember the last time you regretted something you did? Perhaps it was only a few minutes ago when I started telling some of those things. Oh, yes, I've done this, I've done that. And now it's starting to sting you, huh? I promise you, you can overcome that. It's possible. And that is why we seek the truth. So here's what the truth will let you do. The truth will help you understand that there are two phenomena in this world. Let's try and make sense of this. There are two phenomena in this world, ladies and gentlemen. One of these phenomena is called vipaka. It's called vipaka. We can call it nature. We can call it God if you want. Then it's just vipaka. We have no control of vipaka. Vipaka is vipaka. The other part is karma. So these are the two phenomena. Karma is what we have control of. Vipaka we have no control of. But karma is what generates vipaka. So by virtue of that, you can determine what vipaka you get. Therefore, you get to control karma and vipaka. So once again, we have no control over vipaka. That is nature, it's God. But karma, we can determine what karma we want to do. That is our intention, our volition. But karma is what generates vipaka. Without karma, there's no vipaka. Yeah? So if you are able to control your karma, now you're able to control your vipaka. Okay. Where does karma happen? Where does karma happen? Out there? Or in here? All happens here. Where does vipaka happen? All in here. So both karma and vipaka happen inside you. What we're trying to understand here then is the truth. The truth about these two things. The truth about vipaka and the truth about karma. Let me draw on the board for you. Let's first understand what vipaka is. And then I'll also explain to you what karma is. And then you'll see the connection between the two of them. And then we will see how we can ensure that we get to control the vipaka. Although these might sound mind-boggling things, you know, they're not. They're very simple. But it's simple once you understand it. Until you understand it, it seems very complicated. So here's what vipaka is. As far as you're concerned, this is the totality of vipaka. As far as you're concerned. These things are also vipaka. They are products of vipaka. Let's keep it simple for the time being. No need to boil the ocean. This is for the time being. Let's focus our attention on these things. So what do we have on the board? Sight. Sound, smell, taste, touch, and thoughts. And on the other side, you have eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and the mind. When I ask you to think about yourselves, is there anything that does not fall into one of these categories? Think about it for a second. If I now get you to just focus on yourselves for a second, forget everything else around you, forget your surroundings. I'm just asking about you. Is there anything else about you that does not fall into any one of these categories? Start from head to toe. Just scan yourself. Is there? You sure? Yeah? Okay. So you're all of you. So if I take you as an individual, all of you, and then all of you, are one of these. Yeah? This is all vipaka. So then what are you? In one word, vipaka. You are a vipaka. So, what is an arahant? A vipaka. An arahant is a vipaka. Now, what is the difference between you and an arahant then? So if you are all vipaka, and arahant is also vipaka, are you arahants? Well, let me ask that question first. Are you? No. So then clearly there must be a difference between you and an arahant. So if you are also vipaka, and arahant is also a vipaka, is totally a vipaka, what's the difference? The difference is? Difference is karma. The difference is karma. An arahant does not generate karma. Karma is generated in the mind. This is the only instrument that can generate karma. No other instruments can generate karma. There is nothing else in this whole world that can generate karma. In other words, this is the factory for all of this. So the whole world as you know it exists because of the mind. The mind is the creator. Now you don't need to look above for a creator. You are the creator. Your mind is the creator. All things that you see around you, ladies and gentlemen, is a creation of the mind. It is the mind that has created the earth, the sun, the moon, the solar systems, the planets, the whole universe is a creation of the mind. That world out there as well as the world within you. So if you forget the outside world for a second, and that's why I said this can also be explained, but let's put that for aside. Think about the world that you are. You are the world. Okay, now when I say the world, I want to think about yourself. I want you to think about just yourself. Not these things. Not the road, the streets, the trees, the mountains, the hills, none of those things. I just want you to think about yourself and this. I want you to first think about this as the world. This is the world. This is your world. So the sights that you see is part of your world. This is how you know the world, right? The sights that you see. The sounds that you hear is part of your world. smells that you inhale, the taste that you experience, the sound, the touch that you experience, and the thoughts that you have, this is your world. These are the instruments that help you to experience the world. In fact, these are the inlets. It's what bring you impressions of the world. And they all feed the mind. So who's the master here then? Who's the master? The mind is the master. That's why they say mano pubbangama dhamma. Mano setta mano meya. Manasache paduttena bhasati va karoti va. Tato nan dukkha manveti chakkhangva vahato padan. This is the first stanza from the Dhammapada. The mind is foremost. The mind is superior. Of all other faculties, the mind is king. We all have minds. Huh? So you're king then. Hello, kings. So as king of your kingdom, you get to call the shots. You are in power, you have the reign, so you get to call the shots. If you are a well-informed king, then you can live peacefully and lead your subjects gracefully. But if you are a misinformed king, then all sorts of evilness, all sorts of havoc and chaos will befall on your kingdom. So this is your kingdom. And you are king. The mind uses these instruments to bring in inputs from the outside world because the mind is looking for one thing. And what is that one thing? Happiness. Why is the mind looking for happiness? Because it has yet to find happiness. It is yet to find happiness means it is still suffering. So the mind is suffering. Now, we have a problem then. If all of this is vipaka, and if you are wholly vipaka, where's suffering in this? Let's try and find out. Let's together try and work out where suffering comes from. Is suffering in the I? Don't just say no because I asked the question. Is suffering in the I? If suffering were in the eye, what should be true? If we gouge someone's eye out, or if someone's born blind, imagine someone born blind, they shouldn't suffer, right? If suffering's in the eye. Is suffering in sight then? Is it in the sight? Is it? Now that we are not sure of. Why? Because there are certain things that you don't like to see. Yeah? There are certain things you don't like to see and you think, when I see them, I suffer. So you wish not to see them. And when you wish not to see them, you think, that brings me suffering. So therefore, I don't want to look at it. Are you all in agreement with me? Right? Let's just forget Dhamma for a second. I know we've been speaking about anicca and dukkha and anatta and suffering is not out there, but for the time being, let's just be at one with, you know, our natural tendencies, right? So I'm just talking about who you are normally. There are sights that make you unhappy, and when such unhappiness comes to you, you think it is the object that brings you unhappiness. Think of something that you saw recently that made you unhappy. Now let's take, say you see someone beating someone up, or maybe someone being cruel to a poor or innocent animal. Like, you don't like that. It makes you unhappy. Maybe you see a rotten flower or a rotten vegetable, a rotten fruit, anything rotten. You don't like that. Maybe you see a decomposing body. What is your response normally? A decomposing body? Shall I show you one? Not today. Just had breakfast. You don't like the sight of that. Are there not instances in life where you see things and you go, please don't. I don't want to look at that. Of course there are. In those moments, ladies and gentlemen, just, you know, hand on heart, honestly answer this question. In those moments, don't you feel that it is that sight that brought you unhappiness? Don't you honestly feel that way? Think about someone you don't like to see. Is that very difficult to do? Someone you really don't like to see. You really don't want to bump into them, right? They're almost a pest in your life. I think of someone like that. Now, you don't want to see them. When you see them, you feel that it is they who bring you unhappiness. In other words, what you're saying is, sight brings me sorrow. If sight brings you grief, then, because there were Brahmins back in the day who believed in this. They thought that it is sight that brings them grief. It is sight that brings them sorrow and suffering. So what they tried to do was they tried to suppress the faculty of sight. They did. And they managed to do it successfully. You can, honestly. If you contemplate long enough, this is not the Buddha's teaching, by the way. Okay? If you contemplate long enough that it is sight that brings me suffering, oh, may I not be able to see. Why should I have to see all these wretched things in this world? How disgusting they are. How unsightful they are. If you keep contemplating on that, remember, mind is king. If the mind becomes convinced that it is sight that brings its unhappiness, then the mind will shut that down. It will shut it down. In your next incarnation, you can be born without the sense of sight. But you will still suffer. So if that is true for sight, it is true for others as well. And that is how you have the Arupa, which are Brahma worlds. Have you heard of them? There are these worlds called the Arupa, which are Brahma worlds. They're called the formless sphere. It's called formless because in those worlds there is no form. What form? Not F-O-A-M form. F-O-R-M form. Form, not application forms. I mean, a world without application forms would be wonderful, wouldn't it? But not those forms. I'm talking about these kind of forms, you know, forms, these things. Physical things, material things. The things that are the objects to our eyes. Things that are object to our ears. Things that are objects to our five senses. These are the objects to our five senses. These things we call form. In other words, rupa. This is the Abhidhamma term, rupa. That is why they're called the arupavachara worlds. If you put a in front of something, it is the opposite. It is where that is absent. So that's how individuals can be born in the arupavachara worlds. There are 16 of them. But pointless. Because even when you are there, you're still suffering because it is the mind that suffers. So in the arupavachara worlds, you have no eye, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body even, but you still have the mind. So sorry, of the 16 Brahma worlds, 4 of them are arupavachara Brahma worlds. But there are 16 Brahma worlds altogether. 4 of them, arupavachara. Meaning there is no form. The others are, there is form, but there are certain faculties that they don't have. For instance, they don't have the sense of taste. They don't have a physical body like you and I do. So how do you think people get there? By contemplating on the wrong thing. See, this is why they're all short of Nibbana. The Buddha teaches us that Nibbana is Nibbana of the mind. It has nothing to do with the faculties. Because it is not the faculties that bring you suffering. But because people don't understand this, people think that it is these things out there. You know, there are sounds which you find unpleasant. So therefore you try to suppress those sounds. There are sights that you find unpleasant, you try to suppress those sights. There are sensations, physical sensations. Now, there are some people who believe that, you know, it's because of this physical body that I have to suffer, right? If I can just find a way to get rid of this physical body, I'm not talking about suicide, although that is also one method that people think is successful, but far from the truth. Nothing could be further from the truth. But if someone wishes, they can contemplate on it, they can do Anarya Dhyan. There's the Arya Dhyan, the Aryan Dhyanas and the Anarya Dhyanas. There are two types of jhanas. What is a jhana? It is an absorption of the mind. In other words, when the mind focuses on one thing and continuously focuses on that thing, it can become focused on that particular object. And if it continues that practice, in that practice it suppresses the stimuli that come from the outside world. With the belief that it is these five senses that bring me suffering, the mind continues that focus, that practice, and when it dies and is born again, it can be born without any of these senses. But the mind will still be there. But we understand today that suffering is in the mind, because karma happens in the mind. Therefore, it is pointless. But until until a Buddha comes along, they don't know about this. Because it is the Buddha who teaches Mano Pubbangama Dhamma. Mano Setta Mano. But this is all vipaka. So where is suffering here? There is no suffering in vipaka. So none of the vipakas bring you suffering. That's the first lesson I want you to take away from today. There are no sights out there, ladies and gentlemen, that cause you suffering. In just as much as there are no sights out there that cause you pleasure, that bring you happiness. Because if there are things out there that bring you happiness, there have to be things that bring you suffering and unhappiness as well. But there is neither. Happiness and suffering don't come to you from the outside world. They are creations of the mind alone. I'm going to explain to you how the mind does that in just a moment. But first of all, they don't come to you from the outside world. Although I have explained this to you, as you live your normal day-to-day lives, you will still feel this way. You'll still feel that if someone, you know, someone walks up to you and they start swearing at you. Sometimes they start accusing you for things you've never done. Right? Maybe they start guilt-tripping you. And you know, they start scolding you, shouting at you, saying bad words, right? Sometimes, you know, these things can hurt you. Someone tries to attack you. Someone accuses you. These things will hurt you. When those things happen, do try, if at all possible, to come to your senses and remember what you learned from this Sunday, from this Sunday's talk. Yes, I feel like suffering is coming to me from the outside, but Swami Nose told me that it's not. It doesn't come from the outside. Let me explain to you the danger of thinking that things come from the outside. It's not just you suppressing your sense organs. That's not the only thing. Here's what happens. Why do people do unmeritorious deeds? Think about it for a second. Why do people do unmeritorious deeds? Take the first one. There are 10 unmeritorious deeds that we know. The first one is killing, panatipata. Why would someone kill if they didn't think that suffering or unhappiness comes from the outside? There's no reason to do that, is there? So the very reason that killing any living being is done is because people believe that suffering comes from the outside. It comes to us from the outside. And also happiness comes from the outside, because you might think, well, what about slaughtering animals for food? That's also killing. That's not because suffering comes from the outside, but you think an animal's flesh can bring you happiness. You think that taste can bring you happiness. If you again think that happiness comes from the outside, now there is reason to kill. So either one of these two things, happiness or unhappiness, if you believe its source is on the outside, then there is reason to kill. There'll be a time where you'll try to tolerate it, you'll be patient as much as you can, but then it'll come a point where you can't bear it any longer. And at that point, by hook or by crook, you will get what you want. What about theft? Take another example. You see someone walking along the road. Now, you know, these examples, they don't really suit you, but this is what people do. Okay? Why do people thieve? Why do people steal? You see, you know, someone sees someone walking out. But you have this experience. When you are finely dressed with all your adornments, right, your fine jewelry, are you not always very cautious and very careful? Don't you have to be? If you have something valuable on you, don't you have to be very careful? Why are you so careful? Why are you so cautious? Because you know there are people out there who believe that happiness comes from what you've got around your neck. They believe that happiness comes from what you've got in your ears. They believe that happiness comes from what you've got around your wrist or in your pocket. So therefore, they might snatch it from you. Isn't that the thought that you have? Isn't that why you have to be careful and cautious? Yes. Now, you think that's wrong, so why do you wear them? The difference is this. You also believe that happiness comes to you from them, but you are not willing to steal. But they are. It's just the extreme version of you. You also believe that happiness comes to you from the things you put on your body, the adornments, the jewelry and so on. Oh, by the way, this is not saying you shouldn't from now on. Okay? I don't want you all now to walk around town taking off all your jewelry and dressed in white. No. This is not a cult. Just be your normal selves. When you're here, listen to the Dhamma and just be your normal selves. This is not a cult. We are not anti-jewelry cult. We're not like that. Even when you come to the monastery, you can wear your jewelry with you. It's perfectly fine. Come in your finest. It's perfectly fine. How did the kings used to visit the Buddha? In rags. No, in their finest. They used to wash and bathe themselves in perfumed water before they would come to Jetavanarama and adorn themselves with all the finest jewelry. You know, that is how the kings used to come to visit the Buddha. So if it was fine for the kings, what's wrong with us doing it? You're also kings now. So you needn't change any of this. All I am asking you to do is to contemplate on some of these things. We wear jewelry because we believe it brings us happiness. You like the way you look in front of the mirror, when you're stood in front of the mirror with some jewelry on. The difference between you and a thief is you are not willing to go that far. You're not willing to steal for your pleasures. But they are, because they are willing to go that far. This is just a spectrum. On one end, you're not willing to do unmeritorious deeds. On the other end, you're willing to do whatever it takes. So why do people steal? Because they believe happiness or unhappiness, either of these two things or both of them, come from the outside. The same applies to all the unmeritorious deeds. Take the third one, for instance. Kamesu Michachara. Engaging in sensual, or the more conventionally known, sexual misconduct. Why do people engage in sexual misconduct? What do they believe? Happiness comes from the outside. See? These are the dangers. You can't stop yourself totally from engaging in unmeritorious deeds for as long as, come on, complete the sentence for me. For as long as you believe happiness or unhappiness comes to you from the outside world. That is why I urge you, when such thoughts come to your mind, you believe that happiness or unhappiness comes to you from the outside, take a moment to remember what I've shared with you today. If you do that, you can refrain from the unmeritorious deeds. Remember, one of those days, I think a few weeks ago, I explained to you the five precepts. Actually, I didn't explain the five precepts. What I did was, I gave you the purpose behind the five precepts. I told you this is a training. Yeah? Panatipata, Adinnadana, Kame Sumichachara, Musavada, and Suramere Machamadattana, Veramani. I explained to you that once you begin to contemplate on the Dhamma, once you begin to understand the Dhamma, these are the five things that you will naturally refrain from. You don't have to fight against them. An arahant doesn't kill because he's observed the precept. An arahant doesn't lie, right, because he's observed the precept. But, you know, take Siripala from the village, right? Now, maybe he's a fisherman. Let's take Siripala as a fisherman. But on poya days, he doesn't do that. Because he's observed the precept. Is that bad? No, it's good. At least for one day of the month, he doesn't kill. That's good. Take someone who works in an abattoir. Right? They kill animals for food. But for one day of the year or for the month, they don't do that. A butcher. They don't do that. So, you know, like even in Sri Lanka, taverns and shops where they sell, I think, liquor and meat shops as well, do they close them on poya days? They do. Okay. So, those shops, they are shut on poya days. It is symbolic. We know that behind the scenes, in preparation for poya day, you know what really goes on, right? In preparation for poya day, usually sales skyrocket 1 or 2 days before poya day. But that's not the intention. It was intended to be that on those days, people at least reflected that what I am doing is sinful. I have to suffer the consequences. By the way, I've got nothing against eating meat, because eating meat is not sinful. Killing is. Then you have a question, don't you? I know. How do I know? Yes, of course. I didn't fall from the sky. Go back a few hundred years, our ancestors, they also got their fair share of nutrition. They needed meats. They got it. And they did so by going into the jungles. And there would be leftover carcasses, leftover by predators who'd eaten animals, who'd killed animals, and they'd leave the carcass. So they would have consumed some of it, and the remainder would be left over. That's why they were called hunter-gatherers back then. They gathered the hunted. They didn't hunt. They gathered the hunted. So who hunted? The beasts, the predators hunted. They hunted, they probably ate half of the animal, and the other half they left. So they would go and stand by watching, and when the beast would leave, when it was safe enough to do so, they would go and collect it and they would bring it home. Now they could take their fair share of proteins without actually killing. But of course, we as human beings, we advance every day on day, right? And now what we do is we have our own farms where we rear to kill. Killing is bad. Eating meat is not bad. If it were, the Buddha would have accepted the Devadatta's request to lay down a commandment that all monks should be vegetarians. He rejected that. He rejected that. Point blank, he rejected. In fact, he came with five requests, and all five of them he rejected. One of such requests was all monks should be vegetarian. He said, no. If they choose to be vegetarian, then let them be. If they don't, so be it, because they're not doing anything unmeritorious or anything sinful. But don't kill for food or for any reason. In fact, let's say you were offering something to the Mahasangha, right? Say something that was a meat product. If the monk knew that you had it killed so that you could offer it to the monks, we have to reject it. We can't take it. That is the, these are the rules that have been laid down by the most compassionate one. But of course, if you go to the shop, yes, there is meat there. So if you're, say, you're giving an almsgiving, wherever, right? I mean, wherever. However you choose to do it. This is not me saying you have to do one way or the other. But sometimes, you know, you'll have these problems. Should I? Shouldn't I? Is it okay? Because sometimes you will see some monks, they might take meat and or fish, other monks may not, and you might think, well, those monks are more virtuous than the others. Don't judge a monk's virtue based on what they eat. How can you make that decision? One monk is a vegetarian, but he plays omi every evening, and he drinks. Now he's a womanizer. But he's virtuous because he's vegetarian. How do you know what happens behind closed doors? You only see what happens when they come to the alms hall, right? But once they leave, how do you know? So the best thing to do is to think that all monks are virtuous, because then you're safe. Then you're safe. Because if you begin to judge a monk's virtue in the way that you understand it, now one of these days you're going to come across an arahant. And perhaps you're going to offer him some meat, because you've cooked some at home and some was left over perhaps, and you went and offered him and he accepted it. And you thought, can't be an arahant. No. Why? He accepted the meat that I offered him. Can't be an arahant. That is not so, ladies and gentlemen. I'm sharing these things, I will, from time to time, because otherwise these will be problems that you will have in your head, and then, you know, these, they'll bother you. They'll begin to torment you from time to time. When you go for an almsgiving, you see some monks taking, others monks don't. You might wonder, are they more virtuous than others, and so on. Safest thing to do is don't judge anybody. The only person to judge is who? Just judge yourself. Don't judge anybody else. So another request that the Devadatta made, the Devadatta Thera made, was all monks should live under a tree. They should not live in shelters other than the shelter of a tree. Ruksamulika. This is what Devadatta requested of the Buddha. And the Buddha said, no. If they choose to do so, then so be it. If not, then don't. I mean, just imagine if the Buddha said, okay. They want a monk in Saudi Arabia. What are we going to do? In a desert somewhere, there are some people, they need the Dhamma. Like my first encounter with a monk, I was in Oman at the time. And in those days, you know, I lived in a part of the country that was, actually there were a lot of deserts, you know, there was hardly any trees at all. I was fortunate enough to receive a monk, and the first time I'd seen one, really, at that young age, this is the monk I went and gave my hand and said, good morning. And he said, no, sit down. Because I didn't know how to greet a monk. Then I thought, how rude. But the Devadatta asked of this. He requested the Buddha to lay down a commandment, and the Buddha said no. And there were some other things he requested. He said, Venerable Sir, I request that all monks should be allowed to carry a sachet of salt with them. Why? Because if the food is unpalatable. If it has not been salted properly, then the monks can add a little bit of salt and have it to their liking. And the Buddha would have said what? That's not a bad idea, Devadatta. You think so? The Buddha who says that food is purely to sate your hunger and to fulfill your nourishment requirements, your nutrition requirements. It is not for the purpose of taste. That's why you sometimes ask, how is it that Swaminasa takes all these things into the same alms bowl? There's pudding in there, there's biscuit in there, there's rice in there, there's gravy in there. How can you eat all of it together? Well, the problem that you have, ladies and gentlemen, is because you want to taste them separately. Otherwise, if you have your starters, your main course and your dessert, don't they all go into the same place? at the end of 1.5 hours, are they not all in the same sachet? Huh? But as they pass the tongue, you want them to give you different individual tastes. And that's how you enjoy your food. It's okay. But soon enough you'll realize what a meaningless task that is. How useless it is to separate your food. And because, you know, then you have to wash how many dishes? How many dishes do you think I have to wash when I get back to the monastery? One. All of it in the same alms bowl. But imagine my lay life. In my lay life, we used to have 6-7 different dishes all cooked and laid out on a table. And even when we had visitors, right, but when they leave, who has to wash the dishes? We have to wash the dishes. Different dishes, meaning each dish, a different container, they have to be washed. Cooked separately. What a bother. For no point, no purpose, except for satisfying the tongue. But it's not the tongue who needs it. It is the mind. Why so? Coming back to the point that I was trying to make earlier, because the mind seeks happiness from the outside. That's why. Can I give you a simple example? I don't mean to make this a repulsive example, but I think it'll make sense to you if I share this with you. Let's just say, now sometimes when you see if there's a certain food that is mixed with saliva, your own saliva, okay, don't you find that a little bit off-putting? Give me a virtual nod. Don't give me a real one. Just a virtual nod, right? The very food, your food, right? Food with your own saliva, you still find that disgusting. So much so that if you spat, when you have something in your mouth, you spat, you don't want it on your body, right? You find it disgusting. But that is what passes down your mouth into your stomach. So it's already within you. Every mouthful you take, you're taking that into your body. But you just don't like to touch it, you don't like to smell it, you don't like to see it. But it's all inside of you. What if I asked you to take some food into your mouth, chew it, spit it out, and eat it again? No. Can you? Don't try this at home. I mean, you can if you want, but not on my account. Because if you start throwing up, then people start wondering, what happened to you, Zuha? You were fine until now. What's wrong with you? Swami Nazi asked us to eat and chew and feed it again, and what happens? You are not going to that sermon again. So not on my account, please. See, you find it disgusting. But that's what's in your mouth, and you swallow it without a problem. Think about it. The problem is, the mind looks for happiness from the outside. Because it thinks saliva is disgusting. That's why. So, you know, this is the very reason that at our monastery, when we talk about this pilikul bhavana, we do that, pilikul bhavana. But not the way that you understand it. Not the way that it is conventionally practiced. Because conventionally, pilikul bhavana, as you may have heard it in other places or in reading in books or whatever, is practicing or contemplating on how repulsive the body is, how disgusting the body is, like sweat, ugh, saliva, even more ugh, blood, yuck, feces, oh, it's getting worse, urine, pus. All disgusting things, right? But it's fine for you to carry it around with you. All 6 feet of you. It's all in there, but it's repulsive. Hair, nails, skin, teeth. Repulsive, is it? No. It's not repulsive. The contemplation that we do, when we do pilikul bhavana, This is what we do is Patikula Bhavana, not Pilikula Bhavana. We contemplate on the fact that it is merely a manifestation. That is what we contemplate on. See, when the Buddha teaches Kayanupassana, he teaches us to contemplate on a body. A decomposing body is used as an example, because there were plenty of them back then, ladies and gentlemen. Today, you know, where do you see a decomposing body? You can't even put one online. They give you a strike. You can't do that, because it's all yucky. It should be hidden from the world, so that only beautiful, wonderful things are shown on the internet. But back then, there were open cemeteries. There were open cemeteries. So people, monks at the time, you know, they could go and sit down at a cemetery and reflect on it. To these days, if a monk would go to a cemetery, you know, they'd bring the police. They'd wonder, what are you doing here? But those days, it was possible. So what monks used to do is they used to go and watch a decomposing body, but they would have at least have to have become a sotapanna first, so that they understand the Dhamma. Without an understanding of anicca, if you look at a decomposing body, the only contemplation you can do then is, it's disgusting, it's decomposing. If that is disgusting, I'm also disgusting. Oh, I want to off with myself. There are some who have practiced that meditation and they've gone and committed suicide because they think, such a disgusting piece of equipment I have to carry around with me. Yuck, I just want to get out of this shell. I just want to get out of this body. That is the wrong practice. There is no place for suicide in Buddhism. There's no place for that. I don't know of any other teaching that puts so much value on human life. I honestly don't. Because humanness is an opportunity to attain Nibbana. Not to go to the heavens, to attain Nibbana. It's an opportunity for that. So what did the monks used to do? They used to watch a body decomposing. So at the beginning it would begin to bloat, right? And then the skin would start to peel off, and then you'd see the maggots, right, grow in there and starting to do its thing. And then the pus would start flowing out of it. It would start to, you know, bloat even further, and then it would start to decompose. So what monks used to do back then was to watch it and understand that this is purely matter-changing configuration. This is a manifestation. There was no fixed body there to rot. This is purely a manifestation. Matter and energy manifested as this body while it was alive. But now there is no longer a source of energy. Once you're dead, there's no source of energy. Now you're at the mercy of the maggots. You're at the mercy of nature. So now nature will do to you what it does. Because now nature is going to have it her way. So therefore, heat, energy, right, whatever starts acting on the body will start to decompose it. So what the monks used to contemplate back then was, this is the nature of a body. What is a body after all? What is a body? What do you understand as a body? Is it this? Human body? Even the human body, ladies and gentlemen, when I say the word body here, when we do these discussions here, when I say the word body, I want you to think of a collection. Like a body of water. What is a body of water? It's where you collect water, right? Where water is collected, that is a body. This is a body because there are things that are collected and they are together. Because they are together, they manifest as a human body. So really, a human body is a collection of things that manifest themselves as human. That is what a human body is. Those are the parts and components that the Buddha then laid out. Kesa, Naka, Loma, Danta, Tacho, Mansang, Naharu, Atti, Attiminja, Vakkang, Hadayang, Yakanang, Pihakang, Pappasang, Kilomakang, and so on. These are the parts that come together to manifest a human body. They're not fixed. See, again, anicca was the contemplation there as well. So, looking at a decomposing body, the monks would contemplate, if that is a manifestation, then so is this. So then how can I claim this to be my body? That was the contemplation that they had. It was not a case of repulsion, because repulsion and affection are two sides of the same coin. Love and hate are two sides of the same coin. You can't attain Nibbana by working on that kind of contemplation, because there, what you're feeding is aversion. If you look at a body and you enjoy what you see, you're feeding desire. If you look at a body and you're repulsed by it, you're feeding aversion. Both of these go against Nibbana. So I would encourage you not to subscribe to such practices for your own benefit. Well, I can only give you my tuppence worth. It's up to you what you want to do. But I suggest both affection and, let's say, conflict, both of these, they go against Nibbana. They're both rooted in moha, which is delusion. What is that delusion after all? The delusion that there are fixed things in this world, not anicca. They're just fixed things in this world. So what is vipaka again? This is all vipaka. And I want to try and conclude this to a certain point before we bring today's sermon to a close. I sometimes take sidetracks. I take diversions from time to time. I hope that's okay. Because otherwise I'm not going to come here and do a sermon on the request of Devadatta to the Buddha. They'll just come up when they come up, and then I'll share with you some of those things which I feel might be relevant to you, and then we'll come back to the main point of discussion and we'll carry on. So, but the disadvantage to you in doing that is sometimes the point that I want to get across to you might take a couple of weeks to get through. Because my intention was to discuss something else, but I've started talking about something altogether different. But anything you learn here is going to be useful stuff. It might not all be to a syllabus, if you like, because I don't have a syllabus. I just come along and see what might interest you today. That is your merits again. Right. So coming back again to vipaka, all of this is vipaka, but what you don't see here is karma. An arahant is someone who does not do karma. Let me rephrase that. An arahant is someone in whom karma doesn't happen. Remember this conversation we had? There's no doer but the done. There's no doer, just the done. So it would be wrong for me to say that an arahant doesn't do karma, because you don't do karma either. Karma is done. Let me explain to you how karma is done. To kick off the karma process, you need a vipaka. Does that make sense? To kick off the karma process, you need a vipaka. And vipaka will always come as a pair, because sight cannot come to you alone, it has to come through the eye, mustn't it? Sound cannot come to you just by itself, it has to come through the ear. Because these are the five sense organs that feed the mind. So ultimately, who are we trying to satisfy here? The mind, nothing else. The eye does not need to be satisfied, let's understand that. The ear does not need to be satisfied, it is satisfied already. It does not need satisfaction. None of your organs, none of your sense organs need to be satisfied. In other words, maybe there are times where, you know, you want to say someone walks past you, right? And, I mean, I'll take one side of this example, others can relate to it. You know, you're a young man, you see a woman walking past, right? Maybe scantily clad, let's just say, right? And you want to have a look at that. You know you're not supposed to. You're married. You have children. But you can't help it. In those times, you might feel like you want to turn your head. Do understand that that is not your head wanting to turn. Because people have come up with this nice saying, the mind is willing, but the flesh is weak. Have you not heard that? Yes. See, they're making a scapegoat out of the flesh. The flesh is always innocent. The flesh doesn't want to turn. It's the mind that wishes to turn. So what the mind does is, because it is now vexed, it wants to have a look at that sight. So what it will do is, it will make use of the energy that is available to it to completely configure this body this arrangement so that that sight can now be taken in through the eyes. So it will turn your head and take that sight so that the mind can be fed. The mind is so greedy. It can never be satisfied. How many attractive women have you looked at by now? Are you satisfied? If so, then how do people get addicted to pornography? If the mind can be satisfied, how can there be such a thing as addiction to pornography? I mean, then it should only be required once, right? You watch it once, satisfied. Don't need it anymore, mama, you can disconnect the internet. No, it doesn't work like that. You become addicted. So the fact that addiction is possible is evidence then of what? That the mind cannot be satisfied. Seeking pleasure from the outside is not a path to happiness because it is never achievable. And the reason, ladies and gentlemen, is because happiness does not exist out there. It reminds me of Kisa Gotami. Remember, she went from door to door asking for some mustard seeds. Did she find any? She found the mustard, but what she couldn't find was mustard from a house where no one had died. Yeah? In the same manner, if you use your five senses to find happiness, you will find sight, you will find sound, you will find smell, taste, touch, but what you won't find is happiness, because there is no sight that inherently has happiness within it. But the mind thinks it does, so therefore it doesn't give up. That's why sometimes I, you know, say hats off to you all. The Buddha gave up, but you haven't. You have more determination than the Buddha. I respect you for that. 2,500 years ago, he decided, no, I give up. I'm fed up of this. Trying to find happiness through by pleasing my senses, not going to work. I give up. But what have you been doing? Still? You still haven't given up that fight. The mind can't be satisfied by giving it sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, because it is not sight, sound, smell, taste, touch that the mind wants. The mind wants happiness, and it's not in the sight. Let's quickly figure out why that is. So we said the karma process starts with the vipaka. So vipaka will be a sight coming into contact with the eye. Okay? So, for instance, I've just placed this pen in front of you. So as I hold this pen in front of you, I'm not now focused on the pen itself. What I'm focused is on sight. This is not the sight. This is the object. I have only one object here. But if there are 100 people in the audience right now, there are 100 sights, but only one object. So what am I trying to get across through that point? Sight is not the same as object. If two of you leave this room, now there are 98 sights and one object. Does that make sense? If five of you come back into this room, now there are 103 sights. By sight, I mean this sight, S-I-G-H-T sight. So sight is not the same as object. This is the object. Sight only happens within you. Okay? In the same way, sound happens within you. Outside is only the object. In fact, there is no such thing called sound out there. Simple physics teaches us that. What there is vibrations. Yeah, vibrations we perceive as sound, don't we? Yeah. So, this is a vipaka. The vipaka process has now started. It kicks off the process. What is the purpose of the mind? Put the seeking pleasure or happiness to aside for a second. We discussed the five things that the mind does: receiving, registering, recognizing, responding, and perceiving. Yeah? In Pali, it's Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, and Vijnana. These are the five things. together this is a mind. So you can't say the mind receives, recognizes, registers, responds or perceives, because it is the totality of them that is the mind. Take out any one of these, it's not the mind anymore. So these five parts together is the mind. In other words, the mind is a manifestation. Manifestation of what? Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. When they happen, that is the mind. Take out any one of them, that is no longer the mind. So the mind Allah itself is a manifestation. Were you all here for last week's talk? Ah, I see some nods. Did you at least get a chance to watch it? We talked about no and on. Yes? Put your hand up if you've not watched this part of the talk from the previous weeks. Just give me a quick show of hands. Ah, there are a few. Ever so quickly. N and O, O and N. These are the same causes, but the arrangement is different. Although the causes are the same, change the arrangement and you get a different manifestation. You know that no is not the same as on. They are very different words. They conjure within you different emotions. You perceive them differently. Right? So they're not the same thing, but they're the same causes, but a different arrangement. That is what I tried to get across to you last week as a manifestation. Yesterday's talk at the Dhamma, at the monastery, I took another example. Star and same causes, but different arrangement. Do they bring the same emotion within you? No, one star, the other is rats. I'm afraid, I think today you can't see on the screen behind me. So, star and rats, the same letters, but written in the reverse order. Different emotion. Yeah? Because you perceive them differently because it's a different manifestation. Right. So, if you haven't watched that talk, I suggest you go back and watch it. Now, we've started the process. This is a vipaka. It started the mental process. And now we've gotten as far as Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. So we are now, I'm trying to explain to you where karma happens. You see the vipaka? In a moment you will see where karma happens. The mind, is ignorant. It has to be ignorant, otherwise karma doesn't happen. So karma only happens in a mind that is ignorant. Ignorant of what? Happiness exists out there. Simple as. Because there are two types of karmas, mainly. There's a third type, let's not worry about that for a second. There are two types of karmas that you day to day engage in. These are punya karma and papa karma. Good deeds and bad deeds. There's one called the Aninjabi karma. We don't need to worry about that for now. So, punya karma and papa karma. These are both done with the expectation that happiness can come to me from the outside. See, remember when I told you, when you offer something, maybe an alms to a monk or water to the Buddha, to the Buddha Puja, whatever. Remember I asked you to make this determination in your mind, may I and all sentient beings attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana? Generally, that is not the intention that people have. Generally speaking, what people offer, they expect in return. So they give something and they expect, may I have that in return? In other words, they are doing a punya karma. It's not bad, it's okay, but it's not great. See, goodness is the biggest obstacle to greatness. That's the thing. It's a good deed, but it's not a great deed. In a great deed, you don't do a punya karma, you do a kusala karma. They're different things. A punya karma is a karma. It generates energy, karmic energy, which keeps on feeding this process. It's like charging up a battery. You keep on charging the battery. But a kusala karma, actually it's not a kusala karma, you can call it a kusala kriya. They're not karmas. Kusala kriya. In a kusala kriya, what you're doing is really, you make the object of your deed Nibbana. the objective of your deed becomes Nibbana. No material things in return. Why? Why might you want that? What does the mind want all the time? Happiness. If I offer something to you, let's take this pen for instance. If I believe I can achieve happiness from this pen, I might give you a pen expecting 100 pence in return. It's not a bad deal, because I believe happiness comes in a pen. But then once you realize that actually happiness is not in any of these material things, it is only in Nibbana, now what do you want to offer? What would you want to offer after that? Nibbana. So therefore, the objective of any of your deeds become Nibbana. I'm talking about a mindset that is actually only in sight for someone like a Sotapanna or someone who's close to that stage. Because it is only a Sotapanna who has clearly understood what Nibbana is. But you can have Dhammanusari, Saddhanusari. These are two avenues to Sotapanna, to becoming a stream enterer. Dhammanusari is someone, nothing to do with the sari, someone who is inclined towards the Dhamma, is a Dhammanusari. Right? They choose, their avenue is more inclined to the Dhamma. So they contemplate on the Dhamma, they reflect on the Dhamma, their understanding of the Dhamma is refined. Saddhanusari is where they're also impressed by the Dhamma, but they have a lot more faith. They are full of devotion. There are some, who practice the path, they're not full of devotion. Like, you don't see a lot of devotion in them, they don't come and worship or, make offerings or like that. But they are very committed to the Dhamma. They practice the Dhamma very diligently and they're always contemplating on Dhamma. Very, wisdom faculty is superior in them. There are five faculties that the Buddha speaks of. Shraddha, Virya, Sati, Samadhi, Prajna. These five faculties are faculties that you will hone on your path to Nibbana. Some people have more Shraddha than Prajna. Others have more Virya than any of the other four. Some have more Sati. Some have more Samadhi. Others have more Prajna. It's fine. And you needn't worry which one I am. I meaning you. You needn't worry which one you are. Because you can't be dead certain which one you are. You might get some inclination of it, but you needn't worry about it. And here's the reason. When you're listening to a Dhamma sermon, and in the Buddha's words, it is then and only then. When you're listening to the Dhamma sermon, all five of these faculties are developed. All five of these faculties. When you're listening to a sermon. I don't know why he's stated that. He hasn't said the same about meditation or chanting. He's only said this about listening to a sermon. He says when you're listening to a sermon, it could be a sermon you're preaching as well, you're still listening to it. In that time, all your five faculties are being developed at simultaneously. So that's a wonderful opportunity that we all have. Where will we again? See, sidetracks. Why do you do this to me? Stop asking those questions in your mind. So, Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara, Vijnana, the process has now started. What you're looking for is happiness and the mind is ignorance. What is this ignorance now? The ignorance that happiness exists in the outside world. So, here's a chitta that has just arisen and this chitta is looking for happiness in the outside world. What is the outside world again? Vipaka. Vipaka is what I mean by the world now. So now this chitta is looking for happiness in what? Remember the six things I wrote down on the board? The 12 of them? Sights, eye, sounds, nose, ear, and so on. So, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and thoughts. Now, the chitta is expecting happiness to come through them. It is expecting happiness to come from the sight. Expecting happiness to come through taste. Expecting happiness to come through smell. But does it? Does it inherently have any happiness? How do we know this? Well, we've gone through various examples to convince ourselves of that fact. If there's happiness in a particular sight, should it not make all of us happy? But one simple example is enough for you to be convinced of this. You don't all have the same favorite color. There you go. You don't all wear the same perfume. So it's not the same smell that makes everyone happy. You don't all have the same favorite food. There you go. See, different things make you happy. Therefore, happiness cannot be in any object. If it were, then we must all be able to consume that and be satisfied. But we don't. And another evidence I've given you in the past, if something brings you happiness, then taking more of it should make you what? More happy. But take a piece of cake, the first one is always tastier than the second slice. No? And the third slice is less tastier than the second one. The fourth, less tastier. The fifth, less tastier. By the sixth one, you're saying enough. And that's not just because you're filling up here. You're getting sick of it. See, happiness is not in the outside world. You've already experienced this, but the mind is still not willing to accept this. Because the mind hasn't understood this philosophy. That's why. You're being fooled. All the time you're being fooled. You're fooling yourselves, really. So, the mind expects happiness to come from sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch and thoughts, but they don't bring them because they don't have it, they can't offer it. Now, what's going to happen is, the mind goes into a state of vexation. Vexation is a state of yearning, it's a state of longing, it's a needy state. You know, it's like the mind's a beggar at that point. Please give me happiness, I need it. That's what the mind's looking for. So, along comes the sight. And the mind is just grappling it, doing whatever it can, trying to get happiness out of it, but it cannot offer happiness, because happiness is not within it. But the mind doesn't give up. It keeps on fighting, keeps on that battle. And then what happens, ladies and gentlemen, is when the mind can't get what it wants, it has a feature, a very special feature that only minds have. No other force in this whole world has this feature. But a mind does. Do you remember those videos I showed you the other day? How a mind can be fooled? Remember? I showed you some video clips the other day about... The what? From the travel... the insurance company. The? Oh yeah, the cat. The cat video and the dog video. And there was the surgeons trying to revive a patient. Yeah? You remember those videos? So, that day, hopefully you were convinced that the mind can easily be fooled. The same thing happens here. Remember the other day I talked to you also how people go insane? Insanity. You've seen people gone mad. I'm actually talking about mad people. It's not meant to insult anyone, but madness can happen in the mind. Madness happens when the mind cannot take it anymore. It becomes so stressful, so vexatious, and there comes a point where I absolutely need it now, give it or I'm going to go insane. If you pass that threshold, the mind actually does go insane. I have seen several mothers in my lifetime, mothers who've lost their young children, and they've gone insane, but in their insanity, they seek solace. Because once they're insane, they believe that they have their child with them. This is what the mind can do. And if you ever get a chance to go to Angada, if you ever do get a chance to go to Angada, observe some of those cases. They've gone insane because they wanted something so badly, but they couldn't get it. Or they had it and they lost it. Apparently, there's a gentleman around the Horana area. This man walks around holding something imaginary in his hands. He goes broom, 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 broom. He walks around like this. This is a middle-aged person. What do you think he's doing? He's driving. So, they investigated why he was doing this. Several years ago, he'd had a car accident. He'd bought a brand new car. Well, it was new for him, and he'd had an accident, and the car was destroyed beyond repair. And that left him in such a state of shock. When he recovered, And he got to know that his car had been completely decimated. It made him go insane. So now he's found solace, hasn't he? Because now he believes he has his car. That is insanity. See, the same thing happens here, ladies and gentlemen. When the mind believes that that sight, sound, smell, taste and touch can actually give you happiness, but it cannot because it doesn't have it, the mind that then goes into insanity mode. Although you don't realize it, this is happening in every single chitta that is going through your bodies right now. In every single chitta, it is going into an insanity mode. And in that mode, it conjures up a world. See, this is why you feel the person sat next to you is your mother. You feel he's your father. You feel he's your brother. You feel he's your daughter. Or she's your daughter. You feel he's your son. These are all imaginary conceptions that the mind perceives when it is actually not so. These are biological connections which you might think, but then biologically we are connected. Alright, let me give you this then. When you look at your wife, you feel a connection, don't you? You feel she's special, don't you? That's not biological. That's not biological. But you feel that she belongs to you. And she feels you belong to her. How does that sense of belonging come? Is it in the object? If she belongs to you, then how come if you divorce, she can go with another man? If something or someone belongs to you, how can it be used by somebody else? It cannot be possible. If something actually belongs to you, then it can only be available for your consumption, for your use. But it's not. Your sense of belonging is a creation of your own mind. See, this pen, these two pens, okay? Look at it right now. I have a blue pen and a black pen in my hand, and everything seems to be okay. Yeah? But if I just do this, something's not right now, right? What's not right? Yes. The cap is not where it belongs, is how you feel right now. Because you feel this cap belongs to this pen and this cap belongs to this pen. You can't break off that feeling. Try and break it off if you can. On the count of three. Stop thinking that these things belong. One, two. Pointless. If I left these two pens here, one of you, when you come here after the sermon, because you'll find this so unsettling, an extension of this is OCD. No, it is. The extreme case of this is OCD. You can't bear to watch these two things like this. One of you will come here and say, Swaminathan said, look that way, I'll look this way, and you'll just quickly switch. Swap the cats around. Because you believe that these two, you know, they're misplaced. But ask the cap whether it belongs to this pen. Do you think there's even a molecule of this cap that thinks it belongs to a particular pen? Is there? No, but why does it unsettle you then? Because you can't help that feeling. The feeling of belonging. Isn't that why you can't let go of things? The feeling of belonging. Look at your right hand for a second. Who does it belong to? You, right? 3 weeks ago, what was it? A carrot. A sack of potatoes. A bag of onions. A bag of tomatoes. It was a pot of rice 3 weeks ago. But today, you say, this is my hand. And it is my hand. So if something were to happen to this form, this is just a form, this is just matter. But if something were to happen to this matter, you can't help the the sense of fear and grief and sorrow that it conjures up within your own mind. Your mind believes that this hand belongs to you. In just the same way that your mind believes that the person sat next to you, their hand belongs to them. So therefore you are very careful. If it's not someone you know, you are very careful that you don't come into contact with each other. But if it's someone you like, someone you love, then you hold their hand even. But it was just a bag of potatoes 6 weeks ago. It was a sack of onions a month ago. But today you hold it and you say, it's mine. It belongs to me, or it's mine. See, this is a creation of the mind, ladies and gentlemen. Why does the mind create this? Because the mind seeks this from the outside world. It seeks a separation, it seeks happiness. So how does it bring happiness then? This is the last question I'll be talking about for today. Oh, 11 o'clock. How does that bring you happiness? How does this sense of belonging bring you happiness? The mind has a very basic and primitive need to see the world as separate things. I'll talk more about this in next week's talk as well, and in several talks to come. The mind has a very basic and primitive need to see the world as separate things. This is why you feel you're an individual. You feel that you are a separate entity. You have a separate identity to the person sat next to you, even if you are twins. Now, sometimes twins dress alike, don't they? They dress alike to tease others, I think. You know, you can tease someone because, you know, the others don't know. They can't tell the two of them apart. But they know who's the elder one, who's the younger one. They know each other from each other. So they do it as a teaser, a bit of a teaser. But even as twins, you feel that I am me and she is she or he is he. That identity is still sensed in the mind. The mind creates an identity because separation brings the mind happiness. Because it believes in separatedness, I can find happiness. And that is because unless things are separate, you can't compare two things. Try and get that bit on before we conclude for today. Unless things are separate, you can't compare these two things. These two things, you can compare them, can't they? You can say one is better than the other, or one is worse than the other. You can only make this claim because you see a blue pen and you see a black pen. You see them more than manifestations. You see these two things as separate and individual entities, objects. I'm not talking about what the eye sees. I'm talking about what the mind sees, or rather the mind perceives. Through the eye, we all see the same thing. Even an Arahant, the Buddha, we all see the same thing. But the mind perceives these two objects as fixed entities. In other words, this is a pen, this will always be a pen. But you know this is not so. Because this is purely a manifestation. Take the components that make this up. Remember the video we watched last week of the maggots turning into flies? Yeah. So what is the difference between maggots and flies? Take a maggot, pull it apart, bring it back together but in a different arrangement and you get a fly. So there are no such things as fixed maggots. I don't know what you understand when I say fixed maggots. Mobile maggots and fixed maggots? That's not what I mean. What I mean by a fixed maggot is a maggot or any entity in this world. You know, it is not fixed. It is not inherently unchangeable. It is not a permanent entity. They are only manifestations. Like a rainbow, for instance. You know that a rainbow is a constant refraction of light. Not just once, but constantly, isn't it? To see a rainbow, a visible rainbow, you have to constantly keep shining light at water droplets. So the droplets of water, they refract light and then you get a rainbow. So the rainbow that you see at t equals 1, is it the same rainbow that you see at t equals 2? Is it? No, it's not. But science teaches that. We learned through science that T equals 1, T equals 2, you see a different rainbow. But unless you understand this, you think it's just a static rainbow. You don't see a dynamic rainbow. What do I mean by a dynamic rainbow? A changing rainbow? No. What I mean is, a rainbow is constantly being produced. Last example for today. This pen that I have holding in my hand. I have it up here because I'm exerting energy on this, aren't I? So gravity is exerting energy on this, pulling it down. The arm is exerting energy on this, pulling it up. And because they are equal, you see it in equilibrium. Let's start a timer. Right now, the time is T equals 1. At T equals 1, this pen is here because there are two forces acting on it, at least. One this way and one that way. So there's an amount of energy that is working on the pen right now. So we've paused time. Let's play time again. Now it's T equals 2. T equals 2 is not the same as T equals 1. It's a very separate moment on the timeline. It's a different instance. At T equals 2, it's still up here. It hasn't moved an inch. It's still up here. Are you going to tell me that it's the same energy that was applied at T equals 1 that is now at T equals 2? Is it the same energy? It's not the same energy. That is why if I keep holding it like this, after a while I won't be able to hold it like this because energy will run out. Because it's not the same energy. You can think of energy as packets if you wish. These packets are being consumed as we speak. So at T equals 3, it will be a separate lot of packets. At T equals 4, another lot of packets. But you see it as being constant. You see that it is here. But the truth is, actually, it's not fixed here. It is constantly being kept here. Does that make sense to everyone? Just give me a show of hands if that didn't make sense at all. Excellent. So this is up here because energy is constantly being fed to this object. Meaning, the fact that it's here, I'm not talking about the pen now, the fact that an object is here is not a fixed phenomenon, is it? It's a dynamic phenomenon. Meaning, as long as the causes are kept fed, the effect manifests. See, that is what I want to get across to you as cause and effect. You can't separate the effect from its causes. This effect will only manifest, once again, this effect will only manifest for as long as the causes are kept fed. You've got to keep providing the causes for the effect to manifest. That's why it's still up here. Because the same causes are kept fed. Now, we change the causes. Once again, we change the causes. But here, the same causes. But packet by packet, if you were to number these energy packets, right, E1, E2, E3, E4, E5, perhaps they're the same amount of energy. Let's say 10 joules, right? 10 joules, another 10 joules, another 10 joules, another 10 joules. But this is E1, E2, E3, E4. These packets are all, they contain energy. But it's up here because it's the same amount of energy, but it's not the same packet of energy. Different packets of energy. This is like a water fountain. You've all seen a water fountain. If you were to put an object on a fountain, the object looks like it stays static. That is only an apparent truth. But the absolute truth is the water constantly keeps pushing it up. So you see then that there is nothing that is fixed in this world. All there are dynamic transfers, motions of energy. It is constantly being provided. Now then, therefore, how come your bodies are like this? It is not fixed. There are causes that keep your body in this form, in this moment, and again in this moment, and again in this moment, and again in this moment. I can keep on going. So therefore, you are not fixed. You are dynamic. So the fact that your hand is like this, you have your five fingers in this shape, is because constantly there's energy that is kept fed to keep it in this shape. Take out some of that energy, one of your fingers will fall. Take out some of that energy, your skin will start to wrinkle. See, that is what happens with old age. You can't continue to supply the same amount of energy. So therefore, the cells cannot keep themselves taut. they start to lose their flexibility, they start to lose their suppleness, because the energy can no longer be provided. And that's when you see that change. Now, I know I keep saying this is the last thing I say, but I'll say another one. Sorry. But I feel like I have to save you, so I have to say these things. You see, growing old then is only a mental phenomenon. You don't really grow old, because there's nothing to grow old. At t equals 1, it's here because of the causes that were available at t equals 1. At t equals 2, it's here because of the causes that are available at t equals 2. At t equals 2, perhaps we can move it down one notch. But that's just because the causes have changed. It is not that this changed to this. Does that make sense? It is not that this changed to this. This was up here at t equals 1. This is here at t equals 2. This is here at t equals 3. What you're seeing is this. You think this happened to this, so therefore you're talking about change. See, change. Change is not, there's no such thing called change in this world. So old age is only a mental phenomenon. Whatever is available in that moment, ladies and gentlemen, those causes manifest as effects. That is why they would look at the decomposing body and study the decomposing body and realize that in every moment there's energy and there's matter. Whatever matter there is, whatever energy there is, and the interaction between those two manifest the current state. In the next moment, whatever energy there is there, whatever matter is there, manifest in that state. And in every moment, that is the case. Have you heard this? Pachupan dham. It's a Pali term. Pachupan. Forgive me for using a Pali term and trying to explain it through an English servant here. But pachupan is pratyang upan. That is what it means. Pratya are the causes. Upan is born out of. Born out of causes is what pachupanna means. It has nothing to do with focusing on this moment. But whereas people think that pachupanna is to contemplate on this moment. Moment has no significance in Buddhist philosophy, ladies and gentlemen, because this is a timeless Dhamma. There's no place for time in Buddhist philosophy. We don't talk about the past, the present, or the future, because if you talk about the past, the present, or the future, you're talking about an object that has traversed time. We are talking about static objects that has traveled through time. How can something travel through time if it is only manifesting in that moment? See, this at t equals 1 was not the same thing at t equals 2. This is one instance, this is a completely different instance. They are not related. This is not the son of the father. It's not so. This is one instance, this is an wholly independent instance. It's here because of the causes that are here. It'll make more sense again next week. Let's leave it there for today. Any more and it's going to start blowing over your heads. But please don't lose faith. Right? I feel confident that I can start delving into some of the deeper topics with you now. You know, if you've been doing this for 6 months and I see some regular faces, which is very promising, that is very good. So we can continue these talks. Because if you only come once every blue moon, then it's difficult for you to understand this. At least you have to watch them online at home, because we are building up on these sermons one after the other. Yeah? So I'm not talking about the same thing every day. Every day we build up on this. Now, we've been doing this for some time, so if we had to start brand new, I'd have to, start somewhere else again. So, do come along, and if you are bringing someone new to the talks, do encourage them to try and watch at least the last two or three of the previous talks. If not, you know, right from the beginning, at least the last two or three. That would be useful, because otherwise they'll come here and they'll start listening to today's talk and they'll wonder what the heck is he going on about. Because I'm building up on the fundamentals that I've been laying down earlier. Do you remember the very first talks I talked to you about merits? I talked to you about gratitude. Remember? how to be grateful to others, because without that foundation, there's no chance, not a snowball's chance in hell of understanding the Dhamma, because the Dhamma is only for the pure-hearted. The Dhamma is only for the pure-hearted. You have to become a Bodhisattva before you become a Buddha. A Buddha is someone who has understood the Dhamma. A Bodhisattva is someone who has a pure heart, pure enough to understand the Dhamma. You have to love all sentient beings. That is a virtue that you need to practice. Compassion and loving kindness and all of these things, ladies and gentlemen, you have to have in abundance in your heart. Fill your hearts up with as much love and affection towards all. This is not sensual love I'm talking about. This is love expecting nothing in return. Do that as much as you can. The more you do that, the more the truth, the seed of the truth, will take root in your mind. That is the practice of a good Buddhist. Let's conclude for today. Okay. Let us all take a moment then to transfer all the merits that we have acquired to all those who deserve it. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude towards the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, let us transfer these merits to them as they have so painstakingly protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha over the generations and through the passage of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to my teacher, Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident to the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all those who continue to make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be thereby transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. And by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our devotees and friends of the monastery, who for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana continue to sustain the Mahasangha and provide for the construction of the monastery. Those who provide the Mahasangha with shelter, arms, robes and medicines, as well as those who provide their know-how and continue to extend their well wishes, may they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, acquaintances, our employees and employers, and our teachers, as well as those who have made great sacrifices on our behalf. Let us gratefully take a moment to transfer all these merits to them, and by the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the nimas, gods and deities who have committed themselves to fulfilling and preserving the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have predeceased us, our ancestors, our forefathers, those who have passed away in our name, our loved ones, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts that we do and practice the path without hindrance. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to those who make great sacrifices on our behalf to protect and preserve the peace and harmony of our nation. This includes the members of the armed forces as well as the police force. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives in the wars that have been fought and battles that have been waged on our lands. Be their friend or foe, may they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also transfer these merits to those who have lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, pandemics and so on. reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us, those who would have gone all the way possible to make our lives comfortable. May they all rejoice in these merits, and by the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful plane, they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the noble eightfold path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I, and everyone who's helped make this program a success, become a Rahatan Mahanse, an Arahat Theranin Mahanse, in this very life itself, and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The members of the Mahasangha will now transfer their blessings to you. Raga ginnan midatnva Desha ginnan midatnva Moha ginnan midatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetnva Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivan sapa labeva. Tunruange suvisi ananta maha guna belen Sila loka sila satyoma Nibbana parama sukhen sukhita taravetva Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. I'm happy to offer the Piritnu to anyone who wishes to take one with them. If you also have anyone in the family who might be at home and you wish to give one or two to them, you can collect some from me as well. So that we don't end up having a long queue, what I suggest is I will hand the Piritnu to you. You can seek the help from our Swami Mahanses to tie them. Unfortunately, we can only do that with the gents. I'm sorry. Because these are rules of conduct that have been laid down by the Buddha that we must follow to the letter. To me, I don't see men and women here. I only see hearts that need healing and minds that need mending. But conventionally, we must always adhere to convention. If not, we'll get ourselves into a lot of trouble. You understand that. Thank you for your understanding. Jai Ram Sadhguru.